noise level seems to be about the same.
Okay, I thought you were only hearing noise, so the signal of stations also dropped. All right, never mind. I'm sorry.
Okay, George. So basically, our suggestion is not to redesign the antenna that you have, although that probably in the end would be an interesting solution. You just have to kind of try to maneuver it in three-dimensional space and try and optimize the height as best you can. If you keep this antenna as close to the ground as it's presently on, you might get some kind of decent transmission at the higher bands, but as you go to the lower bands, most of your signal is going to point straight up, unfortunately.
Question. Just a matter of trying to position it geographically, up, down, left, right, you know, and then through the degrees. So I'll try that and see how that works for me. I actually ordered a vertical antenna, which I'm waiting to get delivered, so I'm hoping that might help me out a little bit more.
KD2VDW?
Yes, VDW.
Maybe I can suggest that George, if he still has difficulty this week, that he takes a bunch of pictures and posts them to his QRZ page. This way, next week, we can kind of look at it, see what it is, and kind of get an idea of the layout. It's kind of hard to imagine.
Okay, that's a very good idea, and I've mentioned to you, George, that at the very least, you should find some innocuous email address that you can check in on every so often and post that as well on QRZ, so that if anyone has any thoughts after the net, then, you know, they could just throw an email in your general direction.
Mike, that's an excellent suggestion. I'm going to work on that tomorrow. I'll definitely get that up there.
Okay, very good, George. So I wish you luck as always, and I'm sure eventually we'll all figure this out together.
I appreciate everybody's help. It's just, you know, I'm sitting here all by myself. I mean, I know I'm talking to people and people are helping me and giving me advice, but I'm sitting here looking at this stack of radio and tuner and power, and I've had 3 weeks and I still haven't spoken to anybody on it.
Well, if it makes you feel any better, I had my license for about 3 years before I could do anything other than talk to some guy in a repeater.
Chester?
Yes, Chester.
The suggestion about taking pictures of the antenna installation is excellent. I was thinking of that myself so we could picture it better. And also, take pictures of the surrounding area. Like if there's any other supports, maybe somebody could figure out, why don't you run a small little wire over to this tree, very thin wire that no one could see, that type of thing. If you could send some surrounding area pictures, close in, of course, not hundreds of feet away, so that we, whoever was trying to help you, I'd be willing to help you myself. And you can send me pictures right to me, WB2AHK@AOL. I'll look at it. WBaker2AlphaHotelKilo. I've been a ham for quite a while. Put up numerous antennas, and I could probably think of a few things for you. So if you could send me those pictures, as many as possible, I'll get back to you tomorrow. This is WB2AHK.
WB2AHK, what is your name?
I'm Chet, Chicago, C for Charlie, H, E, T, Chet, and I'm in Floral Park, New York. What's your QTH? How far away are you from Floral Park? Go ahead.
Smithtown.
I missed your QTH. Try again.
Chet, I live in Smithtown.
All right, very good. So send pictures to me directly, and I'll even send you my phone number if you send me your pictures, and I'll make some suggestions starting tomorrow, okay?
That's fantastic. I'll make sure I get them over to you. You're WB2AHK. jk@aol.com.
That's Roger. Okay, and we'll see you from my looking at your antenna and looking at the area around your QTH and supports and so on. I'll get a better idea of what's going on, and I'll call you and we'll discuss, okay?
Hey, fantastic. What I'll do is I'll include my phone number in the email.
Okay, back to Roy. Thanks a lot. WB2 Alpha Hotel Kilo.
Okay, thank you, Chet, and George, once again, good luck, and, you know, come back and tell us how everything worked out, or if you have other problems or other questions, you know where to find us all.
Fantastic, Roy. I want to thank everybody for all your suggestions and comments. Chet, I'll get you the pictures tomorrow. Mike, I'll make sure I try to upload those things. I'm looking at the QRZ page right now. I have to figure out how to send myself an email. But I'll talk to you a little bit later. Everybody have a great night. This is KZ2VCQ standing by.
Okay, very good, George. And I guess now is time for the science talk, and Wesley has some topics he would like to discuss.
Yes, indeed. Teleportation.
Yeah, I mean, teleportation is kind of easy to misunderstand. It's not that they're teleporting objects. They're teleporting information, data.
Fermi Lab and partners achieve sustaining high fidelity quantum teleportation. That's the message from today. But of course, it happened December 15, 2020. So it was quite 20 days ago. Available quantum internet, a network in which information is stored in qubits, is shared over the long distances through entanglement, which transforms the fields of data storage, precision sensing, and computing, U-sharing, in a new area of communication. That was done by Fermilab, U.S. Department of Energy, Office Science of the National Laboratory, and their partners. I don't see more companies in it, so it looks like it's a hot object. The number of papers was written, and there was a distance of 44 kilometers. But first, before we go to that. Quantum entanglement is the main phenomena that is behind that. I'm going to start with a silly example, very single silly example. You have a wire of 44 kilometers, and you switch on the power on it. Information is immediately present at the end of the wire, but electron goes very slow. So, now, quantum entanglement.
Wesley?
Go ahead.
It doesn't go instantaneous. It goes at the it sort of depends upon the speed of the signal. It's inherently less than the speed of light in a vacuum.
I might partially agree with you, but yes, I agree with you, it's less than speed of light. And the speed of light is the maximum that the particle can achieve, or the information speed. It's a long conversation. I would have an interesting conversation with you, but let's not go there. So quantum entanglement is entanglement. It's a physical phenomenon that occurs when a pair or group of particles is generated, interact, and share spatial proximity in a way such that the quantum state of each particle of the pair or group cannot be described independently of the state of the others, including the particles are separated by the large distance. But then the information was sent to the distance of 44 kilometers using qubits. say in quantum computing, a qubit or quantum bit. Sometimes qubit, that is called, is a basic unit for quantum information. The quantum version of the classical binary bit physically realized with a two-stage device. So a qubit is a two-stage of two-level quantum mechanical system. One of the simple quantum systems displaying the peculiarity of the quantum mechanics, but trying to be more easy to understand. If we take an example of the spin of an electron in which the two levels can be taken as a spin up and spin down, or the polarization of the single photon in which the two states can be taken to be the vertical polarization and the horizontal polarization, in a classical system a bit would have to be in one state or the other. However, quantum mechanics allows the qubit to be in a coherent superposition. And I'm dealing a lot with polarization, so that is interesting to me. Let me go a little bit further. They started to work on it in 1993, then through 1997. There was numbers of companies, the AT&T was involved with it. But then they made some experimental determination of the quantum teleportation that had been made in information context. But guess what? The teleportation included photons, atoms, electrons, and superconducting circuits. So when Dr. Roy said, well, there was not an object, well, what is an object? A particle? An atom? An atom has a little bit more than photon, which is a pure energy. Let me drop.
Wesley?
Go ahead.
If you read deeply into whenever they use teleporting, they are not alluding to particles being teleported. Unfortunately, this isn't like Star Trek, where you get on the pad and the next minute you're on the moon. What they're discussing is teleportation is moving data, information, from one entangled particle in one location to another entangled particle in another location. So the particles that are entangled are already in their location. The state change because of the entanglement is what's doing the teleporting in just about every article I've ever read on the subject.
Hold on, let's just give me a second. Yeah, I forgot to switch my recorder because every discussion with you, Dr. Roy, is worth to be recorded, to be used as excellent material for teaching or whatever I need it for. Anyhow, let me drop.
Yes, I've heard my voice on YouTube once.
But it's my honor to have the chance and that opportunity. But it's not a compliment. I was talking about experimental determinations. So when you start to oppose or you start to comment, you just skip the word experimental determination. So experimental determination of the quantum teleportation have been made in information content, and it was including photons, including atoms, and including electrons, and superconducting circuits, as well as the distance with 1.4, that would be 870 miles. Yeah, but because 1,400 kilometers is 870 miles. So being the longest distance of successful teleportation by the group of Jian Wei Pan using the Miku satellite for space-based quantum teleportation. So now we're dealing with the two ways of teleporting information. But because photons, atoms, and electrons are not excluded, then we're dealing with teleportation of particles. We need to realize what is the difference between photon and electron. The difference is between photon and electron is that photon is a packet of energy while electron is the mass. So moreover, the photon does not have a rest mass, but an electron has a rest mass. And it's another significant difference between photon and electron. The photon can go at the speed of light, but electron not. It's not. Dr. Roy, any comments?
Well, I mean, I agree with you with the fact that electrons and photons are two different things. One's a boson, one's a fermion. One can occupy the same quantum state with a trillion of its brothers. The other one can't occupy the same quantum state with any of its brothers. But the point is, once again, that what's really going on, in my understanding, is that they are entangling these particles. You can entangle photons, you can entangle electrons, you can super-entangle them. You can entangle different quantum properties. It's not stable. Eventually it decays, it breaks down. But the point is that they entangle them when they are present together. They then take one and send it someplace, which is still not teleportation, and then they change the spin or the polarization of one of the entangled pair, and the other entangled member of the pair at a distance instantaneously changes. The information is being teleported. That's my understanding of the nature of teleportation in this context.
Yeah, I have no problem with what you're saying, and moreover, I agree with what you're saying. Which I usually trying to play devil's advocate. But let me slightly drift from teleportation. Dr. Roy, do photons have acceleration?
No, photons exist at the speed of light. Now, some people will say no. If you put a photon through something with a with a unusual optical density, its apparent speed slows down, and the magic number is the apparent. It's a phase phenomena. The photon itself. Goes at the same speed, and the way that the easy way for me to explain why that's so is when the photon gets out of the optical media where the apparent speed is low, it spontaneously goes back to the speed of light in the vacuum. So ultimately, photons can only travel at the speed of light.
I'm going to approach the same what you said, using different words. Can photon be accelerated? Yes, Dr. Roy. Yes, it can be accelerated. Let me say a little bit more. Surprisingly, we're going to come to the same conclusion, but let me say yes. For instance, when traveling from one medium to the other, light changes speed. In fact, the actual photon is absorbed and the new photon is re-radiated during this process. Another thing is that an unfortunate gravitational lensing that I had a problem with last time.
Wes?
Go ahead.
I hate to disagree. Some people use that explanation, that the reason why light appears to be running slower is because it is absorbed, re-emitted, absorbed, re-emitted, absorbed, re-emitted, which sounds good and makes sense. Unfortunately, further investigation seems to demonstrate that this is not actually what's going on. It is more of a interference of electromagnetic waves that are emitted by the electrons in the optical dense medium that that interfere with the incoming light and cause a phase shift that presents itself as an apparent loss in speed. But apparently, it's not that the photons are being all absorbed and then readmitted over and over again.
You're ruining all of my tricks. Let me go to gravitational lensing. Okay. So, maybe go how the, okay. Gravitational lensing. So I said the last time that gravitational lens is a distribution of matter. So the cluster of galaxies between the distant light source and the observer that is capable of bending the light from the source as the light travels towards the observer. This effect is known as gravitational lensing, and the amount of bending is one of the predictions of Albert Einstein's general theory of relativity. But I'm gonna add something to it. Gravitational lensing has been observed, which means that the photons can bend. An acceleration can be defined in its change of direction, angular acceleration in radians per second. So the answer is positive. Yes, light can be accelerated, but its speed will still be c locally. Now, do you see any disagreement between what you're saying and what I say? Because I don't.
Well, again, it kind of can be somewhat semantics. As far as you and me, the light is bending. We see it bending. Unfortunately, if you start to think of it in terms of the photon thinks it's doing what it's supposed to do, which is traveling in a perfectly straight line. What we cannot perceive is the distortions and the warpage of space-time. They're called geodesics. And the geodesic for a heavy, massive object, and it could be a concentration of energy, or it could be matter. It could be both matter and high concentration energy warp space-time. And it warps the geodesic so that, from our perspective, that light is making a turn when, as far as the light's concerned, it's just traveling on its own straight path through space-time.
I do agree. But now I have a catch question. How do you prevent particles, such as electrons, to manifest itself as a photon?
I'm not quite sure what that means. Electrons can't spontaneously turn into photons by themselves. Theoretically, you can combine an electron with a positron, and in the annihilation, electromagnetic cosmic gamma rays will be emitted. But conservation of lepton numbers and such, you can't simply have an electron just spontaneously turn into a photon.
I don't know what you mean by the word spontaneously.
An electron cannot, you could put an electron under any environment by itself, and it will never turn into a photon. You can do other things, like combine it with a positron, but you can't simply have an electron and, you can have an electron produce photons by speeding them up and then banging them into things, then what you're really doing is changing the kinetic energy of the electron into a photon. The electron remains an electron.
Dr. Roy, I just direct the photon into the atom, and can I rip off the electron in form of photon? So the photon to the electron is, it goes to lower orbit, and the photon is being created. And that photon doesn't have a mass. So yes, by collision, by means of collision, you can change the electron to photon, or at least part of it.
Again, I completely disagree. You might make it semantics, but in order for that to happen, the other thing has to disappear, which it doesn't. If you put a highly energized photon into an atom, it will translate its energy, gets absorbed, and changes the potential energy of the electron, which raises it high enough to escape the positive charge of the nucleus, and you have a free electron. You haven't produced an electron. You've simply freed an electron from where it is. And if you let the electron drop back down, the energy that it loses in going to the ground state will be enough to spontaneously create the photon. So the electron is always an electron.
I don't know if you had the time to go to the Brill-G transition and discuss it, but I must disagree with you, Dr. Boyd. It's a semantically proper what you're saying, but actually we don't understand each other. Let me go to why I raised this question. We have an accelerator, and a particle accelerator, we're trying to find out how it works. The particle accelerator uses electric fields to speed up and increase the energy of a beam of particles, which are steered and focused by magnetic fields. The particle source provides particles, such as protons or electrons, that are to be accelerated. But if that's electrons, it manifests itself as a photon. How can you accelerate the photon and to achieve? So my question was, how do you prevent electron to manifest itself as a photon?
Okay, we're going to have to wrap this up real soon because Paul's in the wings. Again, I disagree with your language. It doesn't convert an electron to a photon. Under many states, conditions, you can do things to electrons that will have an effect that produces a photon. But you have the electron before, you'll have the electron after. All you've done is energized in some way the electron, and then when you took the energy away, the remaining depth of energy is enough to create a photon. So I kind of disagree. Ultimately, the answer to the question then would be, well, you have to kind of limit any kind of excitation to an electron, because if it gets to a certain point, it can spontaneously collide with something and lose kinetic energy, or be trapped by a proton, and that can be converted also to photons and such. So that would be my answer. But we got to wrap this up, and you got to put a bow on it for today.
Which are the conditions for the electron to manifest itself as a photon or as an electron?
Again, I kind of disagree with you. It doesn't manifest itself as a photon. It can produce photons, but it remains an electron, unless you annihilate it, and then it could be lots of other things. But there's such a thing as conservation of lepton numbers, so you could only have electrons turning into other things that have a lepton number, which photons don't. if you have a positron, that's a negative lepton, and a positive lepton, so it adds up to zero, so the annihilation of both of them leads the products with a lepton number of zero, which is everything that isn't a lepton. So, again, I kind of disagree with you.
I'm very happy for the fact that we disagree with something. Positron. We have to see at the origin of it. So the origin of the positron is unhappy atom, which is the nucleus that is very much unhappy and dead isotope. Or during the collision where we have changes to nucleus. So positron can only come from the very core of an atom, and there is no other way, unless we're talking about positrons that are flying around and trying to hit the atom by itself. So the nature of this agreement is actually lack of time. We might have been able to get to the sort of the, some agreement, if I understand what you're trying to prove and what I'm not able to explain because of language limitation. Thank you very much. I appreciate your time.
You're very welcome, Wesley. And just as a kind of tying a bow on it, there are other ways to make positrons. If you have a very high energy gamma ray going through the universe, banging around, and if it's high enough energy, it can spontaneously decay into an electron-positron pair that flies off at different angles and such. So it is theoretically possible to form positrons other way. But thank you very much, Wesley. Thanks to everyone who participated. Once again, to remind people that if you have any mailbag questions, puzzles, topics, or you want me to ask Paul to take a look at something, the email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. The link page is roy.ac2gs.com. It has some very interesting articles that I, if I had time, I would talk to you about. Remember, MikeKC2NJI's wonderful archive site, amateurradio.tv, where he has archives of this technical net going as far back as September of 2006. So thanks to everyone who participated. And now let's hear from Paul with WS2N with the SpaceNet report.
AC2GS, WS2N. With a SpaceNet report for the TechNet. Very good. And
Roy should be a scientist.
Unfortunately, that went downhill. I was ready to be transported. It started up exciting, and then we put the brakes on that. But that was pretty good. I was ready to beam up somewhere. And maybe next week. I'm sure Wesley must have this on his list. He could probably talk about the fusion reactor, the tokamak reactor in Korea that they got about, I think, 10 or 20 seconds out of. That I read about. I would have bet anything he was going to talk about that. But okay, let me go on here with the few topics that I do have. This is WS2N.
Roy should be a scientist.
Very good. And okay with your language, so you're getting better over the years. No problem, Wesley. Okay, the two topics that I have is I always start off with the launches. And, you know, this seems like a regular, you know, the transporter one is a satellite that's going to be launched by the Falcon 9. It's going to send up a series of satellites in one shot. It'll be doing that, 4 days from now. The interesting thing about it, one of the approvals that they got from the FCC is the launch of 10 of the satellites are going to be Starlink satellites. Usually they send up, you know, 60 at a time. This is only going to be 10 with a bunch of other, you know, commercial satellites that are going to be launched. But the reason it's a big deal, it's going into a polar orbit. And the FCC and the Defense, you know, Department with their satellites, they have countless satellites in polar orbit. You know, there's spy satellites, of course, number one. And then there's weather satellites, climate detecting satellites. And all these things could be affected if one of these things, you know, malfunction and destroy itself and create debris at altitude similar to those satellites and in polar orbit. And it's not only us, you know, the ESA, the European Space Agency, Russia, a lot of people have satellites in that orbital plane. But somehow they got an approval, and they will be doing that. And the reason for it is they need to cover with their Starlink system, you know, broadband communication. And we have some CWR ID going by. US2N. So, that, you know, I think that's going to be interesting. Like, for instance, Alaska wouldn't be able to be part of this global system that he's got, that Elon Musk with SpaceX and the Starlink program is underway. They have almost 1,000 satellites in space now. And I think once they get up to 1,400, they'll have complete coverage, global coverage, and they'll be able to implement it. They've gone through a beta program already with some Earth stations connecting to other Earth stations. From what I understand, it's working out okay. But they're up to around almost 1,000 now, and they plan on putting another 400 or 500. And then as they deorbit, as time goes on, or they break and they deorbit them on purpose, so it'll be an ongoing thing for maybe years or decades to come. Anyway, let me continue on, unless somebody has a question on this.
Yes, good evening, KV2NSJ. The name is Sam. I have a question, but it's not related to what you're talking about, so maybe I'll wait because I don't want to throw you off.
Sam, I make an outline. I got plenty of time to do that in the early part of the net. I never lose my place because of that. But sure, go ahead, Sam. KD2NSJ, WS2N.
Yeah, thank you. I apologize again. I know how it feels. Listen, there was an unidentified flying object sighting. I thought it was Arizona or Australia the other day, and the wife called her husband and they taped it. Do you think this is true?
First story, and I believe it was Hawaii. The one I read about, it was a blue object in the sky, and large from, it's hard to tell what large is from when you're standing on the ground. You know, it could be close to you, and you know, it could be small, or it could be, you know, 1,000 miles away, and it could be large, extremely large. So they don't know that yet. And I just heard a preliminary report, and somebody photographed it, and it was supposed to be blue. Well, it was a relatively long object, blue, and eventually it went down and they lost it in the lower horizon. Is that the topic that you have, that you read about, Sam?
That was it, in Hawaii, yes. Do you feel that, I don't want to get crazy, but do you think they're up there?
Me personally, no. I could go on and on with that, but no. Nothing local anyway, you know. You know, you look at the trillions of stars, and yes, somewhere out there, but not here. We have plenty of things in space. There's over 10,000 satellites in space, of which I think around 7,000 are operating right now, and plenty of stuff falling in through the atmosphere, and there's natural phenomena that's always coming through the atmosphere. It's most likely something like that. I don't know. It was a very quick article I saw, so I'll have to wait for more information soon. But personally, no, it's little green men. They're a long, long way off, I think. And they sure aren't floating around in orbit, you know. And I think we would detect them. Back to you, Sam.
Yeah, you're right. Listen, thank you so much. Well, I know you do this program, and I know you're up on everything. That's why I asked. I wasn't trying to put you on the spot. But, all right, and listen, thank you. I understand it could be anything. Like, I didn't realize what you said about that many objects. Oh, my God. Yeah, it could have been anything, a star or whatever. But, all right, I just was waiting to ask you. Okay, finish your program. I apologize again. KD2
NSK. Sometimes we have these sounding rockets, and you know, in Hawaii, they launch from a place called Kwajalein Island, or the atoll. There's a couple of islands there, and the military things, and sometimes sounding rockets. Sometimes and they're also intercepting rockets when they want to test something. They might launch a sounding rocket, and sometimes they'll release chemicals. They've done that on the East Coast as well. They've launched out of West Virginia, Wallops Island, Virginia, Wallops Island. We have a launch complex there. It's actually called Mars is the name of the complex. But they'll launch satellites and release chemicals, and I'm going to guess it's something like that, or maybe a satellite that was coming down through space, deorbiting, breaking up, also having chemicals like suddenly released from that satellite, maybe could cause some kind of light reflection like that. They made it seem like it was light, like it wasn't really a solid object when I was reading. But we'll look into it, and then, of course, we'll continue on week after week talking about that. Any other comments? Okay. We did have a Cygnus spacecraft undocked from the International Space Station. It was hooked up to one of the node modules. They have different modules that they connect these things to, either Unity or Harmony. These are modules with six different ports on it, and some of them have spaceships attached to them right now, and some of them have cargo spaceships attached to them right now, and different ports, and that's how they connect from one module to another, with these ports on these modules, and they named them. They were called Node 1, Node 2, and then Node 3. Node 1 is a Unity module, and they'll attach cargo vehicles to it, or Node 2 is a Harmony module, and they'll attach cargo or crew vehicles to that one. And last week they disconnected, they unberthed a cargo vehicle called Cygnus. Cygnus is a cargo vehicle that's launched from that same island, from the same launch complex I was mentioning before in Wallops Island, Virginia. And back in October they launched an Antares rocket. On top of the Antares rocket is the Cygnus cargo vehicle. And in October, that had docked to That was the payload that had docked to the International Space Station. And they fill it up with junk and debris and stuff. After unloading it, they unload 8,000 pounds worth of science equipment, EVA equipment, food, clothes, and stuff for the astronauts. But then they, as months go by, from October to now, they load it up with junk and debris, and they eventually want to get rid of stuff that they don't need. What they would normally do is unberth it, disconnect the 18 bolts that attach it to the space station, and then that would eventually deorbit and burn up in the atmosphere. But over the last few Cygnus missions, this is number 14, they've launched 14 of these things so far. When I say they, it's now Northrop Grumman. It used to be a company called Orbital ATK, and before that it was Orbital Science. Orbital Science, was bought out by ATK. They called it Orbital ATK, and now they call it Northrop Grumman, because Northrop Grumman bought them up. So now they call it NG-14, or Northrop Grumman number 14, Cygnus vehicle. So now it's separated from the space station, and now the astronauts have put external satellites attached to the vehicle before it separated this way. Now when it separates, they can shoot those small CubeSats off into space. But on the inside of the spacecraft, they have different test equipment that they use. In this case, they're going to be testing a KA responder, a transponder that they can use for communication with the Earth. They utilize this big gigantic trash can as an independent satellite for a couple of weeks. And inside they also have a gigantic box with this they set fire on the inside of this box, and they recorded video, there's telemetry, and they could have different materials inside, and because they're in zero G, they can tell how it burns, how it affects everything. And so they run their own tests. They do now it's going to deorbit, burn up over the South Pacific, where all these cargo vehicles burn up and everything that they put inside, a couple of thousand pounds of stuff will be destroyed. But, it was named after, they name it after people, by the way, after different astronauts that have died over the years. Each one gets its own name, and this one was Kalpana Chawa. She was an astronaut that was on STS-107 years ago, back in 2003. Along with six other crewmates, they spent over 15 days in space, in the space shuttle, Columbia, and they did great work up there. But on a return, Columbia burnt up. It was February 7th, so roughly a month from now. It'll be the anniversary of that destruction when it came through the atmosphere and broke up and unfortunately killed everybody. And found debris all over Texas. They spent months and months looking for debris and trying to figure out what went wrong. They eventually figured out that a piece of insulation tile broke off during launch from the external tank and hit the leading left or port side wing and put a big hole in the carbon-carbon reinforced, that's the heat-resistant leading edge of a wing. Put a big hole in that, and they didn't know it was there. And when they re-entered, heat got inside of that from the friction of re-entry and destroyed the vehicle. But anyway, they named the vehicle after Kalpana, and she gets the honor of having her name on that. Interesting thing about her is she was a ham radio operator, and her call was KD5 ESI. So that
those core letters will never be used again. And along with her, there were two other amateur radio people on board. David Brown was a ham as well, as well as Laurel Clark. She was a ham as well too. They came down with, like I said, with seven people. So, you know, Rick Husband didn't have a call letter, but he was also on board. William McCool, Michael Anderson, and Leon Raymond. He was the first, Ramon, he was the first astronaut that, you know, came from Israel, unfortunately. And he's a bit of a hero over in his country, as well as Kalpana in India, born there and came here and eventually became a United States citizen. And that's the story on that cargo vehicle. Let me drop it. Okay, let me just drop it for an extra second, see if anybody was trying to get in on Echo Link or IRLP. Okay, nothing heard except CW ID. Okay, another topic I wanted to cover is an update on the STS program, the rocket that's being developed to eventually send people to the moon, SLS, the SLS program, Space Launch System. I haven't really talked much about that because everything is really been delayed. I mean, I think it should have been completed years ago, but delay after delay. But they're getting there. You know, they have everything pretty much built now. They expect to launch the first rocket maybe at the end of this year. The first rocket of the SLS will be unmanned. They will put an Orion spacecraft, which is capable of carrying up to four people, eventually to the moon or even to Mars. But they will, they're testing everything. And this will probably be in the news next week. They'll be testing the four main engines on the SLS rocket. The SLS is, if you look at it, it's a gigantic tank, and a big orange tank, similar to the external tank that you used to see on the shuttle. It comes from that design, except it's bigger. And it contains liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen. And what it used to do is they used to have these big 17-inch diameter lines, fuel and oxygen lines, attached to the space shuttle. And that's how you used to fuel the three engines in the space shuttle to get to orbit. Three engines were, like I said, liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen. And they called them RS-25. That was the model number for those engines. And they had three of them. Each one was around 500,000 pounds of thrust. And that used to be what used to bring the orbiter to actual orbit. It had attached to the port side and the starboard side these two massive solid fuel rockets, and each one of those had 3 million pounds of thrust. So between around 2.5 million pounds of thrust. So they totaled everything up. It was around 5.5 million pounds of thrust to get off the launch pad, which was enormous. And everything would separate, and eventually the only thing that came back. Okay, I timed out, but eventually what would come back is just the shuttle itself. In this case, they've done away with the shuttle, made the rocket, fuel tank even bigger, still liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen, and they've attached two boosters to to the side. They used to have, they called them segmented boosters. So there were four sections of these solid boosters, and on the space shuttle. Well, they made them longer. They made five segments with sections longer. So those now produce over 3 million pounds of thrust each, and then at the very bottom of this orange tank that's got all the liquid fuel and oxygen in it, they're using the same engines, actually the same engines, but they soup them up a little bit more. I think it's around 9% more than they used to be. And not only that, instead of three engines, they have four. There is now four RS-25 engines. Now, none of this is reusable. Like with the shuttle itself, three engines used to come back and they used to refurbish them, but they would be able to reuse those engines. They would fly the shuttle back, it would land, and that's what they would do. In fact, the boosters, the solid boosters, used to come down with a parachute, land in the water, they used to recover that, and rebuild them and eventually refly the boosters themselves. In this case, everything is expendable. I mean, the only thing that's going to come back is the Orion spacecraft on top. This whole stack setup has got the orange tank on the very bottom now. It's four engines. And you got the two solid booster rockets. Then above that, you have your second stage. The second stage for now has one RL-10 engine. RL-10 is, again, a liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen engine that delivers 25,000 pounds of thrust. The first, at least two flights of this Artemis system is what they call the whole setup. Artemis will be one unmanned flight, one manned flight. Both will go to the moon. They won't land on the moon. The first unmanned one will orbit the moon a number of times and eventually come back, and the Orion spacecraft will test the heat shield again and parachutes and land on Earth. And the next mission will do the same thing except with crew. They'll have a crew of four go to the moon, orbit the moon, come back. And then after that, it's supposed to be Artemis 3. We'll have to see what happens with the old administration. They were going to go directly land on the moon and come back. With this administration, the new one, I think they're going back to the original dates of probably 2028 instead of 2024 to do that final mission. But I think they're going to change things up a little bit. Instead of going directly to the moon on that third mission, they'll be going to a space station, the Gateway space station. As long as money keeps coming in for the space program, That's the present plan. But we'll see what happens for now. Anyway, they're going to test the four engines this week. And they're going to do that in Mississippi. They have a gigantic test stand. Next Sunday will be the date, the 17th. But next Sunday, they've already put these four engines
that time complete
and the tank itself in this gigantic test stand, and they plan on lighting all four engines off at one time, and it's going to create quite a cloud. It actually creates steam when you burn hydrogen and oxygen in this form. What you see coming off is this steam when you saw the shuttle going up, and once the solid booster is disconnected and the shuttle was still going up, that smoke that you saw from those three engines, in this case four engines, is all steam. So they're going to light these things off and run them for 8 minutes, duplicating as if they were going to orbit. So that's how long the engines would have to fly. At the end of if they were flying, the first stage would separate and come back to Earth, and will burn up or wind up in the Atlantic Ocean. bottom of the electric Atlantic Ocean. They don't plan on recovering these engines at all. They're gone. Boosters, they used to have parachutes. They don't have parachutes anymore. They're going to, let them go into the drink, too.